Joining us now to offer insight on these and other trends is market analyst Sean Hackett. Sean, welcome back.
Thanks, Delaney. Great to be back in Florida-style weather here.
He's appeared on a few market-to-markets, so we figured it's time to get to know Sean Hackett. And one thing that we did find, he really likes it when you slip into radio DJ mode. Hello, I'm Paul Yeager. On this edition of the M2M podcast, market analyst Sean Hackett. Sorry, that's kind of what DJs do when they're trying to sound very special. Before we get going with Sean, I'd really like to hear from you. Either send me an email at markettomarket@iptv.org, rate us in the App Store, leave us a comment, or share an episode with a friend. We really appreciate any way that you get the word out. Share an episode that you really like with a friend of yours. Now, here's Sean Hackett.
In a world where Sean Hackett sits across from me.
You want me to talk that whole way this whole time?
I'm not sure I could get through the interview.
Gotta make you laugh. So I was just telling Sean before we started rolling here, I said, that's one of the things I've always liked. I like to sit into the microphone and make it sound like I'm a bigger deal than I really am. So, Sean, you are a guy who lives in Florida now.
Yes.
You dress like you're in Florida. As we record this today, it's stupid hot, but it is the Midwest. Mm-hmm. But it's also, you're in Florida. You're like this all the time.
All the time. 95, 98% humidity, 108 heat index, probably for the next 6 months without any chance of it being different.
And do you enjoy that?
I do.
Why?
I love the hot. I love the heat. I like running on the beach and sweating and just... You know, when it's minus 10 in Iowa, and I've been here during those times, I don't really want that.
You don't? Oh, yeah. See, and I was just talking, Peter Tubbs and I, or a couple of us were discussing. I'm like, I think today I'm going to post on social media accounts pictures of the snow and the cold just to say, who likes this better versus this? And I'm one that does like the cold.
Yeah.
I guess that's why I'm still here.
And why I'm in Florida.
How long have you been in Florida?
Almost 30 years.
Why'd you move there?
Because my mother moved down, my father moved down, my brother moved down, my wife's parents moved down, and I like the heat and I don't like the cold, so I'm like, why didn't I move down?
So you're not in Boca.
I'm in Boca.
You are in Boca.
Yeah.
Boca Raton?
Yes.
Or is it Boca Raton?
We say Boca Raton.
What's the difference?
If you say Boca Raton, we know you're outsider.
That's what I was thinking you were going to say.
So we always know, oh, you're not from here.
Yeah, you get the finger in the stare.
Yeah.
And you're like, the IHOP that you want to see is over there the tourist destination. We're going to go over here to this restaurant.
They're
going to
gouge you. We're going to get a deal over here.
Yeah. So you're in Boca Raton. That is always, I've always thought of it as a retirement community, but it is an absolute working area with lots of industry.
It used to be strictly retirement. My grandfather moved down there and everybody did, but now it's serious industry is there. I mean, there's big companies and families all over the place. So it's really become a sort of a business metropolis for the area. So it's definitely morphed and changed and, you know, we like it. So
Boca is where in the state? Give me a
southeast.
Yeah, southeast. So you're close to Miami, but not all
45
the way
minutes from Miami. 30 minutes from West Palm Beach, if you want to kind of relate that.
Yeah. Which do you go to, West Palm? Do you like to go to West Palm Beach?
I prefer
Miami?
To go to the West Palm Beach airport if I can.
Oh, you do?
I can. I prefer that because it's more of a smaller airport. It's easier to get in and out. Fort Lauderdale, Miami are, you know, if you have a connecting flight on the other side, it could take you an hour to get there.
Yeah, right. So 30 years ago, where did you move from?
North Jersey, Oakland, which is south of Hackensack. My father had a trucking and warehousing business in Secaucus, or as they say up there, Secaucus.
Yeah. How long did it take for you to lose the accent?
I never really got that.
If I play back tape from you from 40 years ago, are you going to tell me, Sean, that it's not going to sound? So what I'm saying, is that just a stereotype in the Sopranos movie and that's it?
There are a lot of people up there that speak like that. I just made a conscious decision not to.
Yeah. I mean, I know when I visited out there, you're like, oh, I finally heard the accent. It really does sound like, you know, but you do have to work hard to hear it.
You do.
All right. So New Jersey, your dad had a trucking company. Did you have any interest in doing trucking?
I was heavily involved. And actually, I was groomed to take over his trucking and warehousing business. And then the environmental rules in New Jersey changed dramatically, and they have this rule that if you have environmental problems on your property, even though you didn't have anything to do with it, you had to clean it up. And so where he was where they used to test these big jet engines from the 1930s, and they had these big diesel tanks and bunker tanks down there, and they leaked everywhere, and the place was just totally polluted. Curtis Wright was the one that actually did all the damage, but they said my father had to clean it up, and he said, I don't think I can do that. So he sold the business off, and then he moved to Florida. And then I was left going, oh.
Now what?
Now what am I going to do? And that's kind of when I shifted gears and got into really stock trading in the early days. Calling somebody, 800 cold calls a day. This stock's something's going to do well. And I did that for years and was successful.
Just in stocks.
That was at that time in the 90s was just in stocks. I did specialize in agricultural stocks as was my forte in the research that I did. And then the dot-com thing went nuts, and I said, this is not going to end well. This is my opportunity to switch careers and switch locations.
Sure.
So in 99, I switched careers and switched locations and moved down to Florida at that time.
Yeah. So when you said your expertise in the commodities, how did you develop that in New Jersey? I mean, New Jersey is an agriculture state. People don't realize that aren't from there or have been there. There's
right.
a heavy – but not quite the same as what we have in the Midwest. What commodities were you specialized in?
Well, I mean, my father did a lot of trucking warehousing for food companies. And so I remember watching Mark to Market when I was a kid. I watched U.S. Farm Report when I was a kid. I just always was fascinated about farming, growing food, how it all worked out. It was almost a genetic interest for me. And that's why I got into really developing a prominence in agricultural stocks and making recommendations in that area and following the ag cycles and, all that was going on with that. And so it was always eventually at some point I would, get more heavily into it. And, just the way things played out at the time, it was devastating that it didn't take over. At the same time, it was a blessing because now I'm doing what I really want to do and been doing it for a long time now.
You just didn't know that that's what you wanted to do at the time. You thought it would be trucking and routes. So I want to finish up the property that your dad had sold. What ended up happening to that through those environmental rules? Was the next person responsible who he sold it to?
Well, Curtis Wright then had to take care of, because they're the owner of the whole building. And,
okay.
and ultimately, they, when my father sold and, the whole laws of bankruptcy and, there's ways to protect yourself against that, then they had to take care of it on their own. And, Curtis Wright's a big company.
Well, I just didn't know if that was one of those, if you sell it, the next person has to or doesn't have to take care of certain things. Because you know how some rules are that way.
My understanding was that it was not a transference issue. It was more of a grandfathering issue.
So you said you grew up watching the show. How'd you watch Market to Market out there?
It was on TV.
You just watched it on TV.
TV. I forget exactly what time on the weekend it was, but U.S. Farm Report, I remember specifically, U.S. Farm was on Saturday mornings. And then Market to Market, I think, was in the afternoon or something like that. And I just watched both programs literally, religiously every week.
What do you remember about the show? Market to Market at that time?
I just found it just fascinating that, we had these big markets. No one really talked about it. None of my friends talked about it. No one really knew much about it. Yet these huge global markets are going on. Things are moving around. Prices are being impacted. Companies are being impacted. And here are these programs and these really smart people who lived and breathed it, that knew all about it, that had this really small subculture of U.S. industry, and I just found it fascinating that most of the people in our country just were oblivious to what was really going on.
Yeah. So which commodity – I mean, you talked food that you started with. When did you transition corn, beans, wheat? I know you do more of the southern crops too now, cotton and
when I came to Florida, John Roach had just moved down, and he was looking to start his – Boca office. Boca Raton office.
Yes, that's probably what the guy from Perry, Iowa called it. I'm sure. I'll ask him that.
So I just gave him a call and I said, hey, John, here I am. This is what I've done. And I see you're ready to start an office. I'm really excited about agriculture. How about we open the office together and see what we can do? And that's what we did. And then, I got in and started, he's obviously extremely competent in grains. And so I got my starting there and worked on writing. I helped with his newsletter a lot, was very involved in that, and helped grow his subscriptions, go on meetings with him in the Midwest and doing presentations, all the things that, he just had tremendous experience doing. But over time, you know, my entrepreneurial spirit wanted to branch out to more than just grains and softs and other things, and that really wasn't where he wanted to go. And so at some point it just made sense for us to part ways, and that's when I started my own company, Hackett Financial Advisors, in 2007.
So you're with him for almost 10 years, more like 8, 9
years? I think it was like 8 years.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So the newsletter has always been a big thing for him.
Yes.
And the client part. Was that part of the knowledge from him of understanding how to connect with a customer, or was it more of I'm sitting at the table talking about someone's livelihood and how I can help them?
I was very good at the relationship thing with stocks and customers and how to relate. And I mean, I was very good at that. But what I wasn't experienced in doing is with a farmer who has everything on the line and you're speaking with him, and how can you relate to him on that level? You know, I needed some education on that. And he was just brilliant at being able to do that and bridge the gaps and understand, you know, what they needed and how he and we could help them. And that was really valuable for me because I just didn't want to go around trading commodities and trying to make a few rich people money. I really wanted to make a difference and help. Mm-hmm. So,
and that's what you transitioned to your own office. So, John's office in Florida. He's got other offices in the area. Is your only location there in Boca?
That's correct.
Okay, so how many do you have in your firm now?
I mean, it's me, and I have a couple of researchers that help me with, you know, things that, you know, data, get this, pick that, you know, do a 100-year correlation with weather against this, things that I could do, but, you know, the time constraints of it all and that sort of thing. And that's kind of how I've operated.
I wanted to discuss your algorithm. I've heard you talk about that before, I run a program in this. How does one develop one of those and what you see is important to the market that maybe somebody else doesn't see as important or does? And you're like, this is my take on that end result.
Well, for years I watched competent, very well-known analysts talk about commitment of traders and the speculators are record long or record short. But I never saw how, given all this, what am I supposed to do with this information? It was always, well, that's the case and that's the case. But what I found over time is what was a record short position in 2004 is not what the record short position is in 2010. It was like 2 or 3 times greater because the market keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And so my view is, well, if it's a moving target, when is it time to sell? You know, when do we know that that's it for this time? You know, because we're always breaking new records with these things.
Right.
So I said, you know, I need to figure out how I can normalize 2019 to 2009 to 1989, 79, and say, what was a sell signal back in 1979 and how can that equate to what a sell signal would be today? And who are the people that are usually right? And can I back correlate the capital flows of those particular parts of the COT, back test it and get a very good record that, you know, they are going to be a very good indicator for making decisions? And so that's what I did. And then the whole basis of normalizing those constituencies to the open interest, meaning we divide everything by open interest. So that normalizes it. So even though the position in 2004, the short position today is dramatically higher, when you divide by a much larger open interest, you can move it to apples to apples.
Right.
And now you say, well, I know based upon the algorithm and normalizing it, this is a sell signal based upon what has worked decade after decade after decade.
I'm just going to use a random number. So if the sell signal was a 27 then, today that really only means about a 20. So I'm not selling.
Correct.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
That's correct.
So help understand, because there are people who look at markets who might not alter their view or what is a signal to them to what today's number, volume, open interest, open trade, sells. And you have to do that because today's market is so different.
You absolutely have to do it. And not just with commitment of traders or, you know, money flows. You also have to do it with supply. Oh, record supply, corn ending stocks. Yeah, but demand is so much larger that if you don't normalize it to what actually the demand is, you get this false sense of oversupply when you really don't have, you know, a 2 billion bushel carryout today is not what it would have been in 1980s. I mean, it's a totally – and I see so much – misinformation or media putting out misinformation on record stocks. But they never talk about the demand side of the equation. Never talk about there's two sides to tango here with supply and demand. And so it's always frustrating for me. And it's something that I try to make sure everyone gets a clear view of what's the real truth of what the supply means in the bigger picture of the global market.
How do you do self-examination to know, yeah, it might be time to change or alter what my previous 30 years of experience had taught me?
Well, I mean, if I start getting things wrong too often. I mean, you know, look, at the end of the day, my job is to be as right as I can about price forecasting, about making decisions, about hedging decisions as I can. And if something's going on that is making me more consistently wrong than I've been in the past and my indicators are not working like they used to, then I need to, first of all, find out why. Mm-hmm. And is there something going on that I can alter or change in what I'm doing to get myself back on track? So far, that has not happened, but I'm certainly open, you know, with computer trading and algorithms and, you know, automatic, auto intelligence, all these, you know, AI and everything that, you know, maybe there'll come a time where some other thing needs to be brought into the fray in order to better figure these markets. But so far, you know, I haven't found that to be the case. So
what do you find as markets evolve? And you mentioned computer traders. How do you find the person who sits on a farm in southern Illinois competes against a computer that sits in northern Illinois?
How do you find them?
Yeah, I mean, how do you help that one that doesn't have that computer assisted trading option for them? They're calling the co-op or the ethanol plant to see what it is. How do they compete against the electronic trader?
Well, first of all, just awareness. You have to be aware that you are competing against non-entities that don't have a mind, don't have a soul, don't have a emotions, and are built to just be animals with a certain way of doing things, and they're not going to be driven by the same rules that you are. That's the first thing, to be aware. The second thing, just because they're faster, just because, you know, they can trade quicker, just because their resources are larger than yours doesn't mean that you still can't use them to your advantage. The biggest thing that I have seen, talking about trends and things maybe acting mm-hmm. a little differently in the last, especially the last 3 or 4 years, is that the algorithms take much, much longer, in my opinion, to react to outside forces, to outside fundamentals than they used to. So at some point that's frustrating, because the human being, the farmer, goes, how is this market not doing something? And he gets frustrated because he jumped a gun too early, or he's frustrated. But at the same time, it gives him plenty of time to take advantage of the algorithm that's not even remotely thinking about it, because their job is, I'm doing this until some number comes in and tells me to do the opposite thing. And so there's a tremendous disconnect I have found between what the computer is looking at and what's really going on, and there's an opportunity for the farmer, either as a buyer or as a seller, to take advantage of that and actually have plenty of time to do it.
So the computer will get the data of a 7 to 10 day forecast and will get today's forecast, but the farmer sees the rain coming that it was more or less than what I needed. But then, unfortunately, the farmer is stuck with my only 200-acre outlook of what I see right out my office door right now. So is that some of what you're talking about, how they can react quicker but yet too quick ahead of the computer?
There's no doubt there's an element to that. The other thing is just, what data are they pulling?
Yeah.
What interpretation? So give an example. You know, there's some satellite outfits that take pictures and they claim they can see everything. And so just in the last couple of weeks, there's been a couple of the higher profile ones that I won't name, but they've come out with estimates on planted acreage, harvested acres, and yield. But and two of them, there's apparently, are taking a look at the same satellite picture. One has 80 million acres for soybeans harvested. One has 89. Well, if we have two people that are looking at the same picture that supposedly is the clearest thing we can see on a broad scale, and they can't agree within 9 million acres, then the algorithm is subject to the data that they are using, which is subject to huge error as a result.
That's more than a 10% swing.
It's wild.
And that's huge when
I mean,
it comes
the
to
difference
what we're
between 80 and 89 is the difference between $7 soybeans and 11 or 10 or something, you know?
Oh, you opened the door to the prices, Sean. Golly, I was going to go there before.
I'm sorry, we can go back to what we were doing.
the title of the episode, you know, is going to be The $8 Corn Guy, because that's what people call you. You came on in 2018, one of your first experiences. How does one – are you okay with embracing the name first? I'll ask
sure.
you that. Yeah.
So I made the forecast and I stand by it.
You stand by it. So how do you make a forecast like that? And when you, because you just said, I do some self of it, I need to be right more than I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't say that it was going to happen within 2 days.
Correct.
You said it's a long-term trend and here's why.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you still stand by something
that a prediction you make, whether it is $8 corn or $7 or $4 or whatever it is?
Well, whatever the reasons were for the long-term forecast, if I see that they're dramatically different from the way I envision them, then I have to change my forecast, even if it makes me look really bad. I mean, the worst thing to do is to keep going with a forecast that isn't going to happen. The best thing to do is to come clean and say, look, I thought this. This is what happened. I made a mistake, and I correct my mm-hmm. forecast. Having said that, if I don't believe any of that's happened, then I stick by my forecast. So, I mean, this is not the first time I've predicted $8 corn. I mean, I predicted $8 corn in 2005 on record. When there's piles of corn, we had a the storage crisis. Nebraska, you couldn't see the sun. There was so much corn lying around. I made an $8 corn price forecast, and I made an $8 price forecast in my reports in 2009. And I was right on both of them. Now, it doesn't mean I'll be right this time, but I really think there's a very, very compelling case as to why. And the three primary reasons why I still feel $8 corn is very viable over the next, let's say, between now and, let's say, 2022, 2023, in this next 3 to 4 year period, is, first of all, you know, my overall view of the U.S. dollar and the way that that typically moves, ebbs and flows, we're ready for a large ebb downward. And you know, ag markets tend to like a weaker dollar. It's when mm-hmm. the big bulls take place. The 2000s was a weaker dollar. The 70s was a weaker dollar. That hasn't been confirmed or denied. Mm-hmm. So that to me is, well, I'm okay with it because it hasn't confirmed or denied whether I'm right. The second thing was that we were going to see a very significant increase in weather volatility on a global basis based upon the grand solar cycle that I've talked about, that every 220 years we go through this long multi-decade period of low sunspots that causes the jet stream to change its form and causes wild, sudden, aberrant extreme weather.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly been validated so far. I mean, there's no doubt.
In just 2019. In just the last four months.
And my view is this is just the beginning of a lot more to come. So we're already starting to see that play out, not here, but globally. And so I have seen nothing with that forecast to make me shy away from the $8 corn forecast. And then thirdly, specifically on corn, was the idea that China was going down the ethanol path like we did back in the early 2000s. They've decided that they were going to just start, you know, going after the ethanol business and using their corn to produce more and more of it and just in massive, massive quantities every year continuing to grow. So just to put that into perspective, despite African swine fever mm-hmm. and the massive herd liquidation and the massive reduction in the need for bean meal and corn feed, their demand for corn is going to be up this year because ethanol demand is still growing faster. And so to me, when I see that, I'm saying to myself, and then the corn stocks numbers are crashing, just crashing in China. You know, it's not rocket science. You know, they can't go to zero. So, you know, the boom, 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 you know, you start looking at where we're going to run into trouble, where they're going to have to buy a tremendous amount of corn from the open market. And who has all the corn, typically?
Mm-hmm.
Us in South America, and mostly us. So that is still 100% on track. So the only thing that needs to confirm my three stools of the bullish case of $8 corn is the U.S. dollar needs to really start to fall in earnest. And then we have everything working together at the same time.
In your algorithm, there's a part of in your discussion that I don't know where you put it, and that's the letter T for President Trump, because initially in his administration, he didn't want a weaker dollar.
Correct.
He wanted a stronger dollar. And then we started getting into these trade discussions with China, and all of a sudden they're not buying soybeans. They didn't traditionally buy much corn from us.
No.
Prior to as we record this in 2019. Maybe that'll change. And his approach is different than what has been in your algorithm and in your history to understand. So how do you factor that part in all of the things that you're talking? Now, granted, he can't do anything about the weather.
Right.
But he can do something with economic policy that influences the dollar one way or the other. Not totally, but it's something that he's aware of. So how do you factor that in?
Well, I mean, he did start off with, you know, strong dollar. You know, that's what I'm after. But he's clearly – especially in the last 6 months, you know, I mean, he has gone after the Federal Reserve like I've never seen any president ever do before.
Right. Boldly.
Boldly. I mean, not be bashful about it. I mean, you are wrong. You're an idiot. I don't know what exactly said, but I mean, something along those lines. And even the Treasurer Secretary Mnuchin, you know, was talking about, you know, how China's using the currency to gain trade advantage. I've never heard a Treasury Secretary say this before. It's always been, you know,
they tiptoe.
They tiptoe.
And Mnuchin's using a sledgehammer, is what you're saying.
He's using a sledgehammer. So Trump and the Treasurer and others are fully aware of this currency issue. And look, I think President Trump knows that if he goes into the summer of next year with economy on the ropes and the China situation unresolved, he may have a difficult time getting in, because the history of presidents being reelected for a second term with a decelerating economic environment is not very good.
Right.
So what could be the levers that could be used? Certainly getting a trade agreement worked out, but certainly doing something with the currency could be another way that, even if a trade deal isn't worked out, it could be a way to counteract the negative forces and allow for a better economic outcome, especially for the ag industry and the ag states that are so important to him come next summer. So everything says to me that he is very interested in finding ways in which he can help move the dollar psychology in a downward direction. And it happens at a time when the cycle says the dollar is supposed to be weakening based upon the normal history of the last 30, 40 years. So it still fits that this is likely going to happen.
Does one of his tools, I'm not asking you to totally step in as an advisor, but is the trade imbalance? And he claims that the trade imbalance is bad, but many other trade people will tell you, no, actually, that's okay, because that means X, Y, and Z.
Well, I mean, certainly the trade, if we tighten the trade imbalance, you know, one could argue it's dollar strong. You know, it helps the dollar strengthen.
Right.
And I think he's beginning to understand that if they buy more from us and we buy less from them, the dollar's in the, you know, it's not exactly what he wants. It's not exactly the outcome that he wants. That's, I think, the reason why they had, at least it was reported that they had a memorandum of understanding around the currency on top of having a trade agreement, because he was fearful that a dollar could take off on a trade deal, but he wanted to have something in place that says, we can't let that happen. Kind of like what happened in the Plaza Accord of 1985 or 6, whatever it was, when Japan and the U.S. got together and said, we need to lower the yen's value against the dollar and let's get this back into balance. I think that's sort of what they were looking to do, or are still trying to do, with making sure the currency can counteract some of this strong dollar tendency of actually tightening up the trade balance.
When you talk about levers, one of the debates that's going on as we sit here today, Sean, is what is the Federal Reserve going to do? This will come out after the Federal Reserve at the end of July will decide we're cutting interest rates. It sounds like it's not an if, it's a when by how much. That's really the discussion now. If that continues to lower and we lose that ability, if we keep cutting that to offset whatever inflation gain, any concern about what has happened in Japan, where they have the zero interest rates and now they do not have that as an option?
Well, I mean, it is a very significant. I mean, already Europe is in the negative interest rate category, if you can believe it, you know, and we were almost at the zero bound not too long ago before we started raising rates again. So, look, there's not much room to go on that. And there's an argument that there's really not much, you know, there's limited benefit that can come from rates, because we've been doing this for so long that we've got ourselves boxed into a corner that we can't get out of which only more money printing of some sort in some way. I mean, the one thing I have heard, Paul, is that they're considering putting a cap on longer term interest rates as a different lever to pull that they haven't pulled before. So they're saying, okay, we have all this 21, 22 trillion in government debt that keeps growing. So we can't lower interest rates anymore. We can't lower, you know, the short rate anymore. But if we can find a way to print money and keep a cap on long-term rates, maybe that's the way that we find the next stimulus to kick the can down the road a little longer and keep this thing going. That's what I've been hearing.
I hear that I don't study languages as much, but America actually, translated to other languages, does mean kick the can down the road. I think that's how that translates in one of the European languages. I'm not sure.
Oh, we've been doing a very good job.
We're really good at it.
You
Everybody
know?
Says, not my problem, yours. Good luck, my children.
I know.
And that happens. So the Federal Reserve is of interest in, as you said, what they've been dealing with. What can a future presidential candidate or administrations, not just 4 years, because if the president does win re-election, there's going to be somebody in 4 years and 8 years. What if future administrations going to learn from this current administration? Let's be more specific on agriculture and general economy.
I mean, I think the biggest thing is that, you know, the world has gotten larger and more complicated. And for better or for worse, many politicians, including President Trump, think one-dimensionally. The Chinese are taking advantage of us. Tariffs are the way to go. But the tentacles, the unintended consequences from that in farming and now, you know, with Huawei and technology and right. all the things that are starting to happen and increased cost at home, you know, all these things, all of a sudden, wait a minute, these things are really, we didn't mean for all these things to happen. So is the net benefit of all this actually better or worse? I mean, I think the politician needs to think that, you know, that because it's such a complicated, multidimensional global economy, one has to really think about what's the best methodologies in how to achieve what you want instead of this is the way to go and we're just going to keep doing it until it happens, because it that may actually create a worse outcome than not.
The single note is one thing that I think political strategists always preach, that the American yeah. consumer understands a single issue. It's the economy, stupid. It's read my lips. It's we understand simple phrases. Understanding global trade complex, we have to be able to import pork chops from Canada because that way we can sell lumber to South Korea. And you're like, what? Yeah. Well, that's the way it works, because I have something, you have something, but it's not the same things that we needed each time, but we do need each other.
And, you know, the amount of travel that foreigners come to the U.S. has always been huge, you know, net benefit, where we have foreigners coming in, you know, and that's a huge benefit that's been really hurt by the trade war, that farmers are not coming to the U.S. like they did before. There's ghost towns in Las Vegas. Not that I'm promoting Las mm-hmm. Vegas. It's a destination spot. Yeah. But, you know, it's a measure of, you know, that the farmers are balking at coming here, and we lose all that money that would come here, be spent here, create jobs here, is now being deprived. And so is that, you know, it's really complicated. And unfortunately, you're right. I mean, the average person, make America great again. It was a simple, yep. one-dimensional, yep. easy understand, but ever could get around it. That makes sense to me. But in application, you know, you really have to rely on smarter people in their field. Doesn't mean you're not smart, mm-hmm. but smarter people in those fields to determine how to take this simple concept and realize it for the greatest good for all.
Well, and there's always the discussion of you got to travel to understand things, yeah. and not just in the United States. Travel the globe to understand how things work in other places. And there's some people who balk at that, and some are like, yeah, I'd like to, but no, I'm going to keep my money in America. I'm going to go to South Dakota and go see the Badlands versus Budapest or yeah. something like that. Yeah. But on your Las Vegas point, I don't think you realize it. Nashville is the big destination now for all those bachelor parties. Now, that's where – because the NFL draft, I don't know if you remember hearing about that. They had the NFL, the great conglomerate that we can all learn from and how to run a business.
Yeah.
They took their draft in the spring of 2019 and did it in Nashville. And they closed down Broadway and they just had it for 3 days on the strip there with all the music bars. And the bachelorettes and the bachelors who'd come to the town to party were like, wait a minute, why are rooms so expensive? Who are all these people in my partying town? That's why I'm not in Vegas. And so that, you know, things change.
Things change.
And I was just reading this morning before we talked, Nashville, actually how this happened, and I don't know if they're directly correlated, but you talk about zigging and zagging and what does something tell you to do. Nashville, I didn't realize this, they had took a major gamble in 08 or 09 to build a new convention center, which now has spurred a hotel and yeah. another retail and another, you know, all of that stuff that went with it, and they look like a winner. And it probably was deemed at the time in the short-sighted today cycle is very stupid.
Yes.
And now it's looking like it's very
stupid. I'm sure they were criticized from here to kingdom come.
So it's hard to understand what moves we're doing today we think might make sense or not make sense.
Well, there's a difference between – and markets are the same thing. The short-term needs, yeah. the short-term actions that do need to be taken, and the longer-term actions that need to be taken. And so, you know, going back to $8 corn, you know, whenever someone makes that kind of a recommendation, you know, I'll be criticized a lot. People will, you know, say I'm stupid. I don't know what I'm talking about because it didn't happen a month from now or 2 months sure. from now, and it went down 30 cents. So you don't know what you're talking about. But you know, that was a longer term forecast based upon a longer term trajectory. Short term, I put sell recommendations out all the time for farmers to sell because right. that's the short term.
Yeah.
Things that farmers need to do to sell their crop to survive and get to the $8 corn so they can make it really big.
Well, that's what I was going to – yeah, I was going to bring that up when you said that earlier. You did say, you know, a 3-year, and I'm like, well, but we got to get to there. You have to be able to survive
yes.
for the good times, and it's a conserve too. You have to maybe not buy that new thing because I don't necessarily know if I'm going to have profitable corn this year. I might be able to survive 6 months,
yeah.
18 months at most, but I cannot make it to 3 years, so I'm going to have to make a decision. One of our old analysts used to say, how much – old Walt Hackney used to say, well, how much damn money do you want to make? How much greed is in that American farmer? And it's hard to lose – as our old boss used to say before you came on the show, John Nichols used to say, how much money – it's hard to lose money taking a profit.
No, it's very, very true, and I'm a big advocate that you have to do what you have to do today, but keep your feeler about where we're going. So I'm an avid sailor. I've sailed all my life. My dad was an avid sailor, and we would sail for days and weeks without seeing land anywhere. And all we knew is that long term, we knew where we were going.
Yeah,
we knew generally speaking we were going. We know where the destination was, but how we were going to get there was based upon the waves, the weather, the wind, and sometimes it would change abruptly, and we'd have to change plans. But we knew where we were going, mm-hmm. so we did what we had to do to this moment to get to the long term destination. And that's the same thing about farming. I'm very confident there's going to be that bright future out there. But if you're a farmer that isn't farming when $8 corn comes in, it was all for naught.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
All right. I got to ask you a couple questions before we wrap up here. Twitter, how much do you look at it, use it, or ignore it?
I don't really use Twitter at all. Mm-hmm. I really don't. I mean, I don't really look at it that much. I think there's just so much information that's put out there. Some of it, it's very, very hard sometimes to determine what's correct or what's not, or how do you filter it all? And it takes so much of my time to go and filter through all these places and see what's that. I just opt not to spend too much time with that.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a social media presence because I was told you need to do that. whether that's true or not, I don't know. I mean, I put stuff out on LinkedIn, which is my preferred methodology. And every once in a while, I put out something that I think is important. But to me, I think social media is better for picking certain things to talk about when they're really important, not daily sound bites, hourly sound bites about something. I just don't think there's a lot of – everything I hear from farmers is this information overload. I don't know what to think, and I think it does more harm than good if you spend too much time sifting through too much information.
Okay. You mentioned sailing as a hobby. What are your other hobbies?
I like to run.
Yeah.
I'm a big runner.
Did you run this morning?
I did not run this morning.
Do you run when you're on the road much, or is that one of those things you leave for the beach?
I usually run at home. When I'm traveling, I just tend not to do that. I just tend to focus on why I'm here and what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Try not to overeat when I'm traveling. Although my farmer customers I met last night failed to prevent me from doing that.
They didn't know that part of your trip? Itinerary, don't feed Sean after 8. Oh, gosh. You got to have one more. Okay.
I mean, I do like 10Ks and 5Ks, and sometimes I'll do half marathons, that sort of thing. I just get tremendous joy out of doing it. It also clears my mind when I'm running, and I get back, and I'm able to kind of recalibrate and get myself back on a level keel to continue to do what I have to do.
Are you a morning runner, afternoon?
Morning.
Oh, morning. So like 5 a.m. morning guy?
I get up 2 or 3 every morning. I get up at 2 or 3 o'clock every morning, and I'm out early. Yeah.
So then you work for a couple hours and then run
yes.
when the sun comes up
yes.
or it gets close to coming up?
Yeah, I don't like running in the dark. It's one of those things for me, have this nightmare of someone's going to abduct me in the night. No one knows what's going on, and that's
they're going to get you in the van. Wait a minute, that's the $8 corn guy. We don't need him.
He's got enough problems as it is.
I shorted what he sold. He needs to be on the street to help me in my position.
Correct.
All right, Sean Hackett, I appreciate it, and I hope everybody feels a little bit more like they know who this Sean Hackett guy is.
Well, I really appreciate it, Paul. This was great, and it was great to have this conversation with you.
Again, feedback anytime at markettomarket@iptv.org. This has been a production of Iowa Public Television and the Market to Market TV show. I'm Paul Yeager. Thanks for listening.